think it felt like a sort of blank, that there weren't any words that could express what I felt. The feelings felt so raw and profound, if you like, that, you know, if I put down on the page, I feel sad, it was inadequate. So I just had a sense of inadequacy of language.
Hello and welcome to In Writing with me, Hattie Crissell. You might have recognised there the voice of the author and poet, Michael Rosen. Michael has been in the public eye for a very long time in the UK. His first published piece of work was a play, Backbone, which was put on at the Royal Court in London in 1969. And then he started working in children's TV before publishing his first book of children's poetry, Mind Your Own Business, in 1974. He became known for humorous verse, and as a kid I remember reading his collection Wouldn't You Like to Know, illustrated by Quentin Blake. Among children, some of his most famous poems are We're Going on a Bear Hunt, Chocolate Cake and No Breathing in Class, and he talks about the joy of performing those poems in this episode. Michael has also written for adults and children about more serious matters. In 1999, his son Eddie, who was almost 19, died suddenly of meningitis. There was a period after that when Michael couldn't write, and we talk here about how that gradually came back to him. He went on to write Carrying the Elephant in 2002. It's a book of poems for adults that touch on that experience. And then for children, he wrote Michael Rosen's Sad Book in 2004 about grief. In 2020, in the early days of the pandemic and at the age of 74, Michael became very ill with COVID-19. He spent 7 weeks in intensive care, 6 of those on a ventilator. As he recovered, he worked on 2021's Many Different Kinds of Love, a kind of journal of that experience made up of emails written by his wife, journal entries by the hospital staff who looked after him, and poems that he wrote as he worked his way back towards health. He also made a short film with material from that book. In February this year, he published the memoir Getting Better, which looks at recovery and how he's survived his most difficult experiences. I went to visit Michael at his studio in Wood Green, North London, in February. It's a room in a converted factory, and it's hard to describe to you just how full of stuff it is. He sat at his desk, I sort of nestled between bookshelves and piles of sentimental treasures, as you'll hear. He was a wonderful interviewee, he was so welcoming and warm, and we talk about all kinds of things in this episode, including how acting and watching stand-up informed the way that he writes for kids, how writing can help us heal, and how simple, plain language can be used to great effect. Before we get started, this season of In Writing has been sponsored by Curtis Brown Creative, the writing school from the literary and talent agency Curtis Brown. Curtis Brown Creative offer a variety of courses that cover a wide range of topics, genres, and skill levels. If you long to write your own poems, you should have a look at their 6-week online writing poetry course, with teaching videos, notes, and practical writing tasks, presented by award-winning poet and spoken word performer, Anthony Anaxagoru. By the end of the course, you'll have the tools needed to write distinctive poetry and the confidence to experiment with different forms. There's an exclusive discount for In Writing listeners, so use the code INWRITING20 for £20 off the full price of writing poetry or any other 4, 5, or 6 week online course. Visit curtisbrowncreative.co.uk to find out more. This is the final episode in this season of In Writing, very sadly, and I'll be back at the end to say a proper goodbye. But for now, over to Michael Rosen. We always start by talking about the room that you write in, and I presume this is the room where you write.
It is mostly, but I do write in other places simply because I'm on the move, or if I have an idea at 10 o'clock at night, 11 o'clock at night, I'm probably not going to be here, am I? So I'm probably at home. And it's quite nice to write at home when everybody's in bed. I know it's a bit antisocial, isn't it? But it is something quite nice about that. So I do sometimes write at home, sometimes write on the move, on a bus or on a train. But yes, the big stuff, I do write in here. Mm. Yeah.
So you do find quite often that you have ideas late at night and sit down and...
Well, probably 24 hours a day, to be honest about it. I think most writers who are writing regularly, I think you have ideas all day long and all night long.
Yeah.
Yes, I don't think you ever go on holiday. I mean, you might think about other things, but it's almost as if there's a channel open and it's all there, coming up with stuff or listening out for stuff or going back over what you've already just written and think, oh no, I could improve that. I thought of an improvement just today. At the end of, I know we're jumping ahead, but at the end of Getting Better, there's a page called Raisins to be Cheerful.
Yes.
What a fool. I should have called it Rosins to be Cheerful.
Oh, Raisins is also very good.
Well, it's all right, but I suddenly thought it's better. Anyway, stand by for the paperback. I'm not going to change it. It's going to have a little bracket underneath and go, or could this be Rosins to be Cheerful? There you go.
So tell me about this space. I mean, first of all, we're in a sort of studio that's part of a block of studios in, are we in North London?
Wood Green.
London? Yeah, North Wood Green. So describe it for me and tell me, how long have you been here and how did you end up here?
Yes. So this is a place called the Chocolate Factory. And it was a sweetie factory that I think later did make chocolate, but obviously they decided the sweet factory, the chocolate factory. Maybe they thought chocolate sounded better. I'm not sure. There is a history to it, which I haven't fully learnt, but I think at one point they did actually take over Licorice All Sorts.
Oh, wow.
So it makes it quite exciting, the idea that they did genuinely make, because I'm actually quite a fan. And it got converted in several stages. It was going on being converted for quite a while. We moved into a place about 1.5 miles up the road in 2011. And my wife thought it would be a good idea that if I didn't fill the house with books. So I've been in these blocks for about 10 years. Mm. Yeah. And this room, well, it's sort of a bit industrial tech, you know, industrial deck tech. So we've got old Edwardian or perhaps even Victorian windows. We've got unplastered walls. And then we have librarian shelves that you can wheel.
So, brilliant.
You're looking at the end of some librarian shelves, but there's about 7 or 8 of them. And there's big handles on the side. You can't quite see those from where you're sitting. And you turn those round, or if you go between them, I can crush you. You can go in between them and I can just slowly squeeze you and crush you by the shelves. And you can go down in history as the poor woman who was suffocated or squeezed by a library.
In Michael Rosen's archive.
Yes.
I can see why your wife didn't necessarily want you to have all of this in the house,
because you're siding with her, aren't you?
This room is really chock-a-block with stuff, isn't it? Are you a big collector of things?
Yes, mostly just books, but yes, yeah. There are other stuff collects, yes, but it is mostly books. I mean, I haven't got old clothes, but rather tragically I do have some of Eddie's old clothes, and indeed my stepmother decided to give me some of my dad's clothes when he died, so you know, I don't think my dear wife, there's no reason at all why she should have my dad's dressing gown in the house. So I think in one of these cupboards there is my dad's dressing gown, which I do like. I do look at occasionally. But you can see there, it says, see over there, it says Ed's, yeah. E-D-Z, that's Eddie. And I think there are some of his books and school books, and I think a T-shirt that he wrote on.
Oh, that's
so I think that's in there. Yes, that's right.
And so, other than that, a lot of books. I'm seeing Beano's.
They belong to first Joe, who's now 46. So 1978, yes, that would be, wow, 1975. Not quite sure why I've got those. But anyway, and then he then bequeathed his collection onto my son Isaac. So they obviously didn't want them, did they? So they said, it's all right, Dad can have those. So that's why you can see Beano's, yeah, Beano annuals, to be really pedantic.
Do you keep them because they have sentimental value because of the family, or do you keep them because they're brilliant objects, or do you look at them?
I've no idea why I keep them. what you know, it's really a question, the hardest question I think I've had in years. Why do you keep them? I don't know. I look at them and think, Joe Ikes is what I call Isaac. So I think Joe Ikes, I do sometimes take them down, particularly if I mean, because I teach children's literature, there's quite a few things in here that are reference points, either in talks that I'm going to give or I actually take stuff in. So if I'm going to talk about comics, it's quite handy to take in. But why I need 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, there's about 30 of them there, aren't there? I probably only need one, and it maybe not even not that these days, because it's nearly all online, isn't it? So every time I look at this library with a kind of rational head, I kind of think, there probably isn't, I hardly need any of this stuff at all. I mean, there's one or two things that are very specific and unique that you can't find online because it is what it is. So I've got some what are called chat books in that rather disgusting orange folder there. If you open that up, there's some, you don't need to do it now, but anyway, there's some wonderful 19th and I think one or two 18th century, these were the books that were sold on the street. There's sheets of songs and kids' funny stories and so on that were sold on the street in As You Like It. Autolycus comes to sell Touchstone, I think, some a pack. It's what's sometimes called the Beggar's Pack. Well, it's the same thing, but just a little bit later, because that's, after all, about 1600. I haven't got anything that old, though they do exist in the British Library. I think the oldest thing I've got is about 1780 or 1790. Yeah.
Fantastic. I don't think you should get rid of anything.
No, that is my views.
It sounds like it's all very important
stuff. Yeah, there's some Hogarth prints in that thing over there. And there are also some things like all my children's books. I mean, I don't mean mine that I wrote. I mean, the ones that I had as a kid.
You still got them all?
Well, quite a few of them, though some of them mysteriously have got my mother's signature in them because she took them to school. So it's got the stamp Harvey Road Junior School in them.
That just adds texture, I think.
Well,
you've also got a million dictionaries and books about words.
I think they're redundant.
You don't look at them very often.
It's fine. I do love them, and I do occasionally look at them. But I mean, if I'm quick, if I'm in a hurry, say a Roger Thesaurus, which, as it happens, is at Homer. Oh no, yeah. Or Origin of Phrase and Fable. You've got Brewer's there. You've got David Crystal's book on language, which. To be fair, mostly you can't find online. But those big books of literature, I mean, I hate to say it, but you can mostly find this stuff online. I've got a subscription care of my local library to the OED. Well, after that, you don't need any dictionary. I mean, it is just one of the world's greatest. It's one of the ninth wonder. It is the ninth wonder of the world. I mean, there's just millions and millions of words and histories of words and anything you want to, you know, name any word you like and in English and it'll explain it, and
yeah,
it's just extraordinary. So I'm sort of looking up there, I think that big thing that says English on the back of it, I think that is actually a dictionary. it's a bit of a waste of space, really.
You've also got this enormous sort of hi-fi CD player, record player, cassette player, quite retro, if you don't mind me saying so, technology-wise. Do you listen to a lot of music when you're working?
No, it's not plugged in. It's just there because
just
it used to be my favourite thing to do, which was to listen to stuff on it. So I just look at it and imagine what I could listen to. But then if I really quickly want to listen to something, you know what I do? You probably do it as well.
Spotify?
Well, I'm not actually... my daughter keeps saying Spotify, Dad, but I just go to YouTube.
Yeah.
And I just bung in whoever it is, Dusty Springfield or something, and up come 10 things. I mean, musicians will be tearing their hair out listening to this because I'm getting it for free, aren't I? I mean, it's terrible, really. But, you know, I've always liked bluegrass, for example, you know, the music of from America from sort of 20s and 30s. Bang, up they come, Ralph Stanley, you know, it's just wonderful, Bill Monroe.
Yeah.
But more interesting, which you may not have noticed, that thing there, do you know what that is?
The desk?
Yes.
The school desk, is it?
Yes, go on.
I don't know. Is it your school desk?
It's from my school. I visited my old school and they said, we're throwing out the desks. And I looked at it and said, oh, I'll have one of those.
Yeah, that's
because that's my desk.
That's fine.
So I don't know whether I can guarantee I sat at it, but it certainly is a desk from my era. And now the better joke still, what's behind that?
I don't know. What's that?
A sort of table.
Yeah, a kitchen table? No.
Good. With what kind of top? What word would you use to describe that?
Formica?
Formica, you're there. When did Formica first come in?
I don't know.
Well, I'd say the 50s.
Okay.
So we've got a 50s Formica table. Where's it from?
Is it from your childhood house?
From my childhood house. That's why have I got it? Because my dad, when he moved in with my stepmother after my mum had died, he obviously had some old tables around. I think that was in his workshop. And it went on. Then my dear dad died. And my stepmother was clearing up things. And she said, I'm just about to throw this out or something like that. She said, oh, no, actually, Michael said, you wouldn't want, would I want it? I just looked at it and thought, you know, I ate meals off that when I was a kid.
Yeah.
Am I going to say no to that? So even though there's no room for this stuff, I couldn't resist having my childhood table, could I?
Of course not. I mean, I think these things are fabulous. It's just you can't really see them because there's a lot of other stuff on top of them. I feel
don't be pernickety.
They should be displayed somewhere beautifully. Yeah. Well, are you writing something at the moment?
Yeah, I'm always writing something. I'm writing a kind of dream cycle of poems called Out of This World.
That sounds good.
I shouldn't have said that, really. Now it's no longer Out of This World. I've completely ruined it. I'll never be able to write another word. I'm sort of putting to bed a kind of dog odyssey. Oh, it could be called Dogacy. I hadn't thought of that.
And when you are working on a book, which sounds like you always are, do you have any sort of routine in terms of when you're coming in here and when you're sitting down and how long for? And
I can't, because I'm doing too many other things.
Mm.
So if I said I'm going to have a routine, then because I do this lovely radio program, Word of Mouth, I mean, it's lovely because I like doing it. I mean, it's a lovely idea. Or because I'm doing school bookings, or these days I've been kind of adopted by the medical profession to come and talk about nearly dying. Or in fact, being dead, really. They're quite interested in me being dead. And what was it like being dead and that sort of thing. And I tell them, well, I don't really know, actually. you probably know more about that than I do. So if I said I'm now going to work for 3 weeks on this, well, it'd be difficult to do. Mm. Yeah.
So how often do you get in here?
Sometimes I get some consecutive days, but usually it's sort of maybe once or twice a week.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but I'm out quite often. If I made a bit more effort, I'd do half days here. And the reason why is because it's 1.7 miles from home, which is a 30-minute walk for me, which is brilliant exercise.
Mm.
So I could put in my 5 half-hours, which we're supposed to do, by coming here. But some half days, I'm a bit lazy. Instead of I go, I could stay at home instead, so I don't do it. But I should. I should do half days because the tube's just over there, so I could nip to the tube if I was going on into town, you know.
And when you're writing, do you, you know, once you get into a state of flow with it or whatever, do you find that you're, I suppose it's difficult to say because, as you say, you have so many other demands on your time, but I suppose in an ideal world, how many hours do you think you would be sitting in one session? And
I can sit for a long time if I'm writing. It could even be 4 or 5 hours.
Mm.
I have to remind myself that, hang on, you should get up, go for a walk, go outside, go down, have a cup of tea. The cafe downstairs. I have to remind myself not to do that because I think it comes a point where it gets counterproductive.
Mm.
But if there's a bit of an emergency on because there's a deadline, then I don't heed my own warnings. So when I've done a kind of heavy-ish book like my Emil Zola book and there was a deadline and I knew I had sort of a lot of detailed stuff to do, I think there were times when I did 5 and 6 hour stints on it in order to get it done.
Mm. That is quite intense.
Yes, I think it's very different fiction. I mean, I was talking to Richard Osman the other day and he said he has a routine and he gets up in the morning. And I said, well, is there a number of words that you do a day? And to be absolutely honest, I thought he was going to say about 5,000. I mean,
he does seem to be producing books.
Exactly.
At a
and he said
rate,
it's
yeah.
1,000.
Okay, wow, that's
and
a really,
I thought, wow.
That's a good
that's
target,
it
I
is,
think,
because
yeah.
1,000 is so doable. And it means that you don't think, oh, I've got to do 5,000 words today. You think, 1,000, that's it. And you can put it to bed. You say, that's it, there's 1,000. And then the next day, if you're rereading it, it's not too long to correct and think, oh, dear. And if you do want to sort of play around with it, if you're going to do that 1,000 as you're writing, as opposed to just sort of flowing, I thought, that is doable. 1,000 words a day, that's good. Whereas I think I have spoken to other writers who've given themselves a bigger target, possibly Philip Pullman, for example.
If you're starting with a poem, where do you usually start? I think it's in Getting Better you talk about how you think in terms of lines. Is it yes. often that a line comes to mind and then you build the poem out from there, or do you start with a feeling or a word?
A fragment, I think, yes. More often than not, it's a phrase or a fragment. And obviously a phrase is connected to a feeling, a place, a thing, a person. But the people and places and things can float past you without being attached to a phrase that will work in a poem-y sort of a way. So it might just reverberate. I mean, I'm just sort of thinking of many different kinds of love, that as I was becoming more and more conscious, I was aware that doctors and nurses were coming to my bedside and saying, "You were very poorly.
Mm.
You were very poorly." And I just kept thinking, are they telling me that I nearly died, or are they telling me I was just had a bit of a cough? Because very poorly doesn't tell you.
It's ambiguous.
Yeah. So, but they would say it with such seriousness and with such gravity. I did get the impression that they thought that I was...
Poorly might be a bit of an understatement,
yeah.
actually.
Yeah, and so I sort of found it quite funny. It's so English, you know, very poorly. So that's how I started. I just put down on the page, very poorly. And then that sort of triggered off a set of associations. And so quite often that happened. There was another poem I wrote where I began with the word confined. And then I thought, that's the old word for pregnancy. They used to say of women, she's in confinement, did they used to say, or she's going through, I don't know. But it was a word they used about pregnancy and the idea of locking a woman away so she could have a baby, because for heaven's sake, you can't think about women having babies. So I think it was a sort of Victorian word. And I sort of started playing around with that I was in confinement in hospital. So that was sort of exploring the irony of the word, if you like, or the double meanings in it. So quite often it can start with things like that.
Mm. When do you remember first being interested in writing? Was it something that you did a lot as a child?
I think the first moment that I got interested in it, we had a teacher called Miss Grant who said, "This term we're doing dramatic monologues." And we sat down and we had Robert Browning's My Last Duchess, though it's not called that. I think it's called Ferrara, but it always gets called That's My Last Duchess or My Last Duchess or even My Duchess. And I just thought this was brilliant. I thought, what a great idea. I mean, I suppose I had already had my taste buds kind of stimulated by the idea that basically Shakespeare is made up of dramatic monologues that we call soliloquies. But even so, Browning had written this thing that is just on its own, and that it's revealed in the poem that he probably did her in. Spoiler alert, perhaps I shouldn't have said that to people who haven't read the poem. But anyway, there's the implication that he didn't like her and he moved on, and this is what he does. That's My Last Duchess on. Oh my goodness, has he done this to several people? So it's really a kind of whodunit, and I thought this was brilliant. And in fact, the teacher said, I mean, it's just so funny, really, but she said, "Go home and write a dramatic monologue." And so I remember going home and thinking, I can do this. And I wrote a dramatic monologue about a man standing on a beach while someone else is begging for his life and saying, but the man who's speaking is not going to spare him. But you don't quite understand. It's somewhere in one of my exercise books. And I remember thinking, boy, this is good. I like this. And I seem to remember the teacher thinking that I'd done all right. But the very next time where I really thought this is for me, I read James Joyce's Portrait of the Artist as a Young Man. And at the beginning of it, he's writing in a sort of stream of consciousness of the mind of a three-year-old. I think sort of 3, 4, 5-year-old anyway. And I just remember thinking, this is just stunning. that you could imagine being two or three and express that through words alone and by breaking away from syntax and creating these little bursts of thought in the way that three-year-olds sometimes talk. You know, they sometimes say, want, cake, you know, happy. And he's written this. I mean, it's beautiful. It's well worth looking at. And I thought, I could do that. That was sort of first thought. And I sat down and had a go at writing my first memory, which was sitting on a beach. I've still got the memory of feeling too hot. And I think we figured it out once when I was talking to my parents that I must have been about 2.5. So it's a memory from 2.5. And of course, it's a bit blurry. But the idea that I was sort of sitting on a beach and hot on the sand and was the, could it stop, please, sort of thing. Mm. At Margate, I think. So the beach at Margate. So that was the next one. So that's my sort of route into writing, really.
Yeah. And your first book, Mind Your Own Business, was published in 1974.
Yes, it wasn't actually my first book.
Oh, sorry.
My first book was called Backbone, and it was a play.
Oh.
That was in 69, I think.
Okay, and then the next one was Mind Your Own Business.
74, yeah.
Okay. And so how did that come about?
Well.
And it was illustrated by Quentin Blake as well,
yes,
wasn't it?
Yeah. So my mother was doing schools radio programmes. It was a series called Living Language. And my mum and dad cooperated with a bloke called Geoffrey Summerfield in producing the Voices anthologies for Penguin, which used to be very, very famous. They're wonderful, wonderful school anthologies. And my parents were very engaged in this thing about sort of poetry in schools. And round about the time I wrote the James Joyce sort of thing, it was sort of like a prose poem, you see. And I think I wrote a poem, I think I can see it in my little notebook, and it says 1966 at the top, which would make me 20. And I wrote a poem about sharing my bedroom with my brother, and it was in a sort of voice of the child. So I was carrying on from the 2.5-year-old one, but this is really in the voice of an 8-9-year-old sharing his bedroom with his brother, my brother Brian, who's 4 years older than me. And I think my mum showed that one, or possibly another one, to the producer of the programme. And Joan, her name is Joan Griffiths, she had seen the play and she said, oh, has he written any more? So my mum, Connie Rosen, came back and said, have you written any more? Because she didn't know. I said, yeah, I think so. And I dashed upstairs and wrote some more and said, yeah, look, here they are. And mum took them to Joan and Joan said, oh, we could have those on the programme. So that was when I was about 21. And then Joan said, are there any more? And I went, yeah, and wrote some more. And then she asked me to present one of those programmes. So I did that. And then by now I had a collection. And so I tried hawking these around to various publishers, none of whom were very interested. One of whom said children don't like poems written from their point of view.
And I thought, my God.
Well, I don't know. There is a book called Child's Garden of Verses by somebody called Robert Louis Stevenson. Oh, yes. Hang on. There's A.A. Milne. He had done quite well. There was two. Anyway. In the end, a wonderful woman called Pam Royds, she liked them. And she said, I know this really great illustrator called Quentin Blake, who my dad sort of knew, actually, through where he was teaching at the Institute of Education in London. So I met up with Quentin, and that's how the book came about.
Yeah. And I know that in the, I think it was the 70s and 80s, you worked as a writer teacher? Is that the right phrase?
Yeah, they call them a writer in residence, which means that you don't do any writing and you haven't got a residence. So it's a bit like the Holy Roman Emperor, you know, it wasn't holy, wasn't Roman, wasn't an emperor. But I certainly didn't have an empire anyway. So yeah, that's right. I worked in various schools as a writer in residence. Mm. And I mean, effectively, you are a writer teacher because you're sitting there like a peripatetic music teacher, but doing writing with the children.
Yeah.
And not, I mean, in those days before CPR and all the rest of it, you did sometimes do that on your own. So you were a writer teacher standing on your own 2 feet.
Yeah.
I mean, and in those days also, because I had a degree, you didn't need teacher training, believe it or not. So
yeah.
I was technically a writer teacher.
I mean, you've always worked closely with children. You're not just sitting at home writing for children. You're going out and you're performing and you're meeting them and you're visiting schools. And I wondered if working with children over the years, if you think it's changed the way you think or changed the way you write.
Oh, it definitely changed the way I write, because when I was writing those poems way back, let's say 1966, at that time, I mean, I hardly knew any children. I mean, I did know one or two sort of nephews and maybe friends of my parents' kids and so on. But the only child I really knew well was myself. And then suddenly there I was, I'd written this book, which was about me. And people were asking me to go and read the poems to children. And I didn't really quite, I mean, it may sound very odd, but I hadn't quite made the leap. So I just thought it was about me. And so I started reading them, and then I found there were poems, some of them they liked quite a lot. I've had this shirt covered in dirt for years and years and years. It used to be red, but I wore it in bed and it went grey because I wore it all day for years and years and years. The arms fell off in the Monday wash, and you can see my vest through the holes in the chest for years and years and years. I'll keep the bits in a biscuit tin on the mantelpiece. For years and years and years. So, I don't know, I remembered it. So I wrote that, and it was in the book, and then I quickly discovered that they liked it, and they would go for years and years and years, and they'd say, do that again. And I thought, oh, I see. And then so as I was going into schools and libraries and book groups and so on, and suddenly I found I was talking my way into them as well. So I'd say, do you know, I did have an old shirt. I really did. And in fact, I've got the pocket. I haven't got all of it. I've just got the pocket of the shirt, because it was like, it wasn't Boy Scouts, it was the Woodcraft folk actually. But I said, I've got the pocket and it's in my box. It's not. And I started doing this, and then I then started up new stories. And that's how Chocolate Cake came about, because that came about by saying, you know, when you sort of wake up and you think, oh yeah, that lovely chocolate. Do you see? So it became, and I was watching people like Billy Connolly and Jasper Carrot, and thinking, oh, well, you can do that for children. Because they were quite often talking about their childhoods anyway.
Yeah.
And I thought, well, it's my childhood, and I've got these in these poems. And then I was having kids by then anyway, so I started telling stories about Joe and then Eddie and doing Eddie's nappy and things like that. And kids were just loving it. They were just loving these stories about this funny bloke who does make up sort of silly poems like Down Behind the Dustbin, I met a dog called Jim. He didn't know me. I didn't know him. And then I'd tell these stories. And then I thought, well, why don't I write them down? So that's how Chocolate Cake and some of those others, they came out of the ad libs that I was doing in schools. And then that taught me another voice. I could then ad lib a stand-up onto the page.
Yeah.
So that's how it worked.
And you are a wonderful performer. I was watching... I was watching a YouTube video of you doing We're Going on a Bear Hunt, and it's so rhythmic and it's so exciting to hear you perform that. And it made me wonder whether the performing itself has changed the way you write.
Well, yes, it has. Now, we've missed out a kind of pillar of whatever it is. That is that alongside the scribbling that I'm doing that we've just explored, right, I was acting, because I belonged to a youth drama group that was very serious. It was working on Stanislavski techniques at the Questors Theatre in Ealing. And then the moment I went to college and university, I just thought, oh, well, you can just all this theatre stuff. And I was doing a mixture of quite serious theatre, either directing, acting, or doing daft sketches and writing sketches and appearing in them and doing funny voices and, you know, and it was sort of like Footlights, but Oxford. And some of the people have gone on from that into being actors and comedians and all sorts of things. And so I was writing the poems. I hadn't married the two sides of myself, the performer with the poems yet, even though I'd done them on radio. It was a moment when I was performing at Princess Frederica School in Kensal Rise, or Kensal Green, one or the other. And the teacher, the deputy head, an Irish guy called Sean McAlain, had asked me in to perform the poems. And he had a little room to one side of the hall. And he said, I want you to come in, Michael, I want you to come in. And you've got to hear a very strong, wonderful Irish accent while he's saying this. I want you to come in, I want you to come in. And he showed me all these lovely paintings that the children had done, you see. And I said, this is incredible, you know, he's doing all this stuff. And now he's doing poetry and paintings and so on. Not many deputy heads, it's not quite their role, you know. They tend to be up the kind of police end of the profession, you know. Don't squirm, teachers, you're listening to this. But anyway, and then he said, and now the children are waiting for you. And I thought I was going to go into a little room and see about four or five children, you see. And he opened the door and it went straight into the hall. And there were 400, it was the whole school waiting for me.
Little faces looking at you expectantly.
Yeah. And there was this great roar. They kind of went, ooh, ah, because Sean had read my poems to them, you see.
Oh.
And he said, and boys and girls, you know who this is? It's Michael Rosen. Another great big roar. And then he sort of pointed me to get up. So I had Mind Your Own Business in my hand. And I had it open at one of the poems that kids have giggled a bit about, A Ship in the Dock. It's at the end of the trip. So I kind of held it up. But because there were so many of them, I hid my face behind the book because I didn't want them to see me. So I went, The Ship in the Dock's at the end of the trip. The man on board is the captain of the ship. The name of the man is Old Ben Brown. He played the ukulele with his trousers down. You see? Now, London kids will give you about 4 seconds. You know, they give you the benefit of the doubt, maybe five, before they suddenly find each other much, much more interesting than anything that's standing in front of them. So they gave me 4 seconds, and then they found the Velcro on their shoes, the slides in their hair, the bunches. It's all much more interesting, talking about football. And I saw Sean McElhane over there to my right, and there was this look of horror on his face. He had thought that he had invited some kind of live wire into the school, and here I was mumbling and holding this book up in front of my face. So you know what he did? He went, no, it doesn't go like that, does it, boys and girls? Great big expansive gesture. Shall we show Michael Rosen how it goes? Yes. And then he like danced the poem.
Oh.
I mean, it was just incredible. And I just stared at him while he went, The ship in the docks at the end of the trip, like this. I mean, because it sort of, you know, it gave it a rhythm that I hadn't even seen myself. The whole school joined in, right? And they even made the last line a little bit jazzy. Played the ukulele with his trousers down. Played the ukulele with his trousers down. And I'm going, is this what you do? And, of course, I had done that sort of thing myself.
Yeah.
That was what was so daft in doing these silly sketches.
Just hadn't occurred to you to bring that
into the poetry.
Doing this
footlightsy stuff of, you know, like the goodies, like you know, Monty Python. I've done all that stuff, silly walks, all that. And I thought, well, why don't I do that? So that marrying of performance, and, of course, I had actually studied performance at the youth theatre. You know, Stanislavski and all that sort of stuff. And
yeah. Are those things in your mind while you're writing, do you think? You know, when you're choosing the words on the page, do you think you're thinking about the way you're going to perform it later?
Yeah. And in the different styles, you know, if you write something that's very kind of musical or write something, I mean, please forgive me for making comparisons, but, you know, there's occasions when I can hear somebody like Sylvia Plath in my ear. And I think I'd like to write something, and I don't mean this in any derogatory way. I mean, she wrote, it was weird. It was weird stuff, and it's brilliant. I mean, just stunningly brilliant, because she used words in a way that almost every word surprises you that it's there. Mm. And the situation that she's describing is surprising. And it's once you get it into your head that that's what she was doing, that there are times when I've wanted to sort of do a Plath. I can remember writing about just somebody. A big book of bad things. I think it's somebody staring at a slug, is it? But it's sort of an odd thing, an odd moment anyway, that I think she could capture the oddness of a moment. And there's been a couple of times when I wanted to do that. I know there was another one about a daddy long legs and sort of trying to brush it off your face, you know, that it sort of feels like whiskers crossing your face, you know, feels like an animal. And so, you know, that requires a different kind of performance. It requires a kind of slow, sort of not very necessarily very exaggerated. Well, not very sort of, not like in the way I'm describing the others, but then if it's something that's like Eddie in the supermarket, then you want to be waving your arms about, zooming about in the trolley, you know, doing the whole thing. When it works for me, that's what I'm doing. When I do chocolate cake, or when I do no breathing in class, that one.
Yeah.
I can see the laughter on the children's faces because I know that the whole body and the voice and the words are all working together.
Yeah.
So I wrote that no breathing thing with a view to performing it so that I could see myself performing it. No breathing. You see, and then you get the mask face of the thing, you see, and all the kids, you see the whole 500 kids all kind of holding their breath and their eyes popping out. And you go, yes, this is it. And that came from thinking of the performance onto the page and back to the performance.
Yeah. You did an MA and a PhD in the 90s in, was it children's literature and writing? Why did you decide to do that?
The MA came about because I was presenting a programme on Radio 4 called Treasure Islands about children's books. And the more I did it, I thought I need more expertise. It's all very well. I'm just talking about this stuff with my expertise from having done a degree in literature, not in children's literature. And I heard that there were MAs just emerging, one particularly in Reading. And I thought, let me do it. Let me just, you know, find out about what people are saying about children's literature. Also catch up with literary theory and critical theory. So that was the stimulus. It was absolutely wonderful. I mean, it was just breathtaking. Wonderful, wonderful teachers. Opened my eyes to whole areas that I didn't know about. Post-structuralism, narratology, for example, narratology, intertextuality, reading repertoires, all sorts of stuff, psychoanalysis in relation to children's books, all this stuff, and a body of criticism. And the moment I'd done it, I think... a prof at what was then the University of North London, no, the other way around, it was called London Met, she got in touch through a former teacher who was teaching there, and she said, why don't you come in and teach some of our postgrads, or teach some of our students about children's literature? So I did that, and then she said, well, why don't you do a PhD? And I said, no, that'd just be silly. There's no point doing a PhD. She said, well, no, you might like it and stuff. And then there was a kind of strange marriage between them and what was the kind of incipient University of Worcester, who gave me a grant of some sort, I think. And so I started doing a PhD. And one of the reasons why was because they offered a PhD in your own writing, which is now customary in all sorts of universities. It wasn't that common. I think University of East Anglia did it. And so you could put a piece of creative work in its critical, historical or theoretical context. So I was writing You Wait Till I'm Older Than You. That's what I did. I wrote You Wait Till I'm Older Than You and studied myself writing it. And that was my PhD, which I've turned into a book, which is called The Author, which I've self-published. But you can see it on the British Library website. And that was wonderful because I really had to immerse myself in reading theory, writing theory, authorship theory, in order to be able to write it.
Yeah, that sounds fantastic. It's so interesting to sort of stretch your understanding of your craft in that way.
Yeah, and then I've taught ever since on MA courses, a combination of London Met, Birkbeck, and for the last, or since 2013, I've co-devised and co-taught the MA in Children's Literature at Goldsmiths, University of London.
Fantastic. In Getting Better, you talk about using writing for recovery. And you say that you didn't write for over a year after your son, Eddie, died. I wondered what you remember about what it felt like not to be able to write and what it felt like when you came back to writing.
Yes. I think it felt like a sort of blank, that there weren't any words that could express what I felt. It really felt like just words weren't satisfactory. They couldn't come up to it. And I think because the feelings felt so raw and profound, if you like, that, you know, if I put down on the page, I feel sad, it would... inadequate. So I just had a sense of inadequacy of language. But the big thing that I said in the book, it just suddenly undammed, unplugged this, was reading Raymond Carver's On Being Locked Out. Because here, in very plain language, in this wonderful, laconic, you know, Americans are so good at it, whether in poetry or prose, of expressing the sort of deepest things in very ordinary language. They don't feel it necessary to go Latinate or great convoluted sentences and so on. So there's kind of the very opposite of Proust. This is not to condemn Proust by any means, because he was trying to do something, you know, wonderful, and it's just beautiful and terrific. But Americans have got more this idea that you can sort of talk onto the page, whether it's Carl Sandburg or, as I say, Raymond Carver and others, and a certain dryness about it, that you don't have to be kind of overly demonstrative. And in the poem, he's basically locked himself out, you know, everyday occurrence, but he's on an American porch, so he looks back into the room. And without saying so, of course, he's saying he's imagining himself dead. And he, by the end of the poem, you realise he's sort of in grief for himself. And I remember reading this, and it so expressed somehow or other how I felt. But, I mean, it's a completely different experience. You know, I hadn't locked myself out. It wasn't me that was dying. It was, you know, it was Eddie who had died. But it just went, bump. And I said, I can write now. And I started writing stuff. And that became the book, Carrying the Elephant. Some of it just four liners, you know, just about we were on a boat and one of us fell off and waved goodbye, you know. It's just little things, some of them, little tiny fragments, others longer. But I found I could just talk, and some of it was sort of symbolic, like that one, and others more direct about what I'd heard or what I'd seen. And, I thought, I can do this. This is saying how I feel, but without me saying how I feel.
Yes.
So that's that brilliant thing that Chinese poetry discovered all those years ago in the Ming Dynasty, I think. The poets Li Bo, I think it is, and Du Fu, I think I'm saying that right, or Dofu. I'm not sure I've got the names right. I know I said the names once, and some Chinese students kind of burst out laughing because I sort of probably said, you know, the tomato and the radish or something instead of the name of the poet. But anyway, they knew who I meant. So I'm a bit cautious about saying their names. Anyway, and they, you know, the Chinese poetry from 1,000 years ago, they discovered that you could express the most profound emotions without using emotion words, just by talking about a leaf falling from a tree and then landing on a river and then floating down to the sea.
Yes.
And that's about your old age without you ever saying it is.
Yes.
And so Carver and Kenneth Rexroth, I think he's another person who translated quite a few haiku. There's a guy with an Irish name. And Kenneth Patchen, some of these people, they can do the demonstrative stuff. They can do the Allen Ginsberg stuff, but some of them have got that very dry, laconic thing. The Spoon River anthology as well. I think his name's Edgar Masters, if I'm right. So I've learnt a lot from all of them.
Yes, I definitely found many different kinds of love. I think I started it on the tube, and I suppose it, because it's about your experience with COVID, and the book begins with the sort of early part of the pandemic where none of us knew what was going on. And I think we've moved on because life moves on. But reading that, even though your language is always very understated and you're the furthest thing from hysterical in your writing, but I started crying on the tube because it just conjured up in an understated sort of way the terror really of that time and, you know, how little we understood about what was happening. And
yes, that's right. I think sometimes it just depends, isn't it? You know, I'd never want to condemn somebody to, you know, don't use emotion words. You know, sometimes people can do it stunningly and brilliantly, particularly in song. But I just found that distantiated way of doing it. So you distance yourself and do it. And then I've found a way also of making it even more so by sort of filleting it. And I've made a film of it. And that's been quite interesting because by filleting it, you sort of get down to an even more of a core.
Mm.
And that's what I tried to do to write that script for it. So I've sort of performed it, and obviously the nurses' letters, which are so overwhelming in their kindness and simplicity, exactly that, you know, you can do it, you know, or God bless even, just anything. God, you know, they didn't know who I was, you know. I mean, I don't mean they didn't know I was Michael Rosen. I mean, they've got this bunch of people and there they are, saving their lives or experiencing, even worse, you know, nearly half of us dying.
Mm.
You know, you come in the morning, like I record that bloke, Dan, saying, he called me Mr. Jacobs, you know, anonymised us. And he said, yeah, Mr. Jacobs still alive.
So matter of fact.
That is so profound. What does that tell you? That he went home that night. It doesn't say it, but he went home that night and thought, well, probably old Mr. Jacobs is going to cop it tonight. He was looking pretty grey and grisly. And he just writes in, Mr. Jacobs still alive. I just love that. It's just every time I look at that, I just think that is so workmanlike. You know, this is work. They come in and you've got a body in front of you and it may be alive and it may be dead. And he's noting alive, you know.
Yeah.
Number 223, who I've called Mr. Jacobs, still alive, very good. 28, not so lucky.
Yeah. Did you enjoy working with other people's words on that book and you know, using that wonderful material of all those letters from the nurses and the helpers? And
well, another hat I've worn all my life is to celebrate, if, for want of a better word, working class literature, the voice of working people. You know, I worked with Ewan McColl, that's what he created the radio ballads out of. And at various times I've read Studs Terkel or I've done radio programmes and so on, where I wanted people who doing stuff to talk about how they do it. I've got a bit distance from it in recent years, but anyway. And then as I looked at the nurse's diary, I kind of realised, well, this is the most poignant of working people's stuff that I know, because here they are saving my life. And they're talking about, well, you know, we proned you last night, took seven of us to turn you over. And you go, oh, God, that is such poetry. You know, seven people. I mean, look at me, right? I'm 6 foot two. I mean, all right, I probably wasn't very heavy by then because I was sort of wasting away. But, you know, I was about 13 stone, something like that. So you bet it took. And, of course, there's all tubes hanging out of me. Mm. So you've got to make sure that the connection isn't broken. And then they must have gone, one, two, three, hop! You know, over he goes. Yeah, that's right. He may be alive in the morning, may not be. But anyway, we'll give this a try. And there's something, again, I just... Or the nurse who says, I've seen from the pictures on the wall you support Arsenal. And when I said that, I think she said something about you being aware of it. But you didn't seem very impressed when I said I support Derby. So look, there's this slab of bloke in front of her. And she thinks to be nice, she's going to say, talk about footy. And then she says, I support Derby. And then, I mean, there were times, as far as I know, that I haven't said this in the thing, actually, was that I was staring with my eyes open for about 2 days, unconscious, and they had to keep putting stuff in my eyes to stop them drying out. And, you know, when she says you don't feel too impressed, I mean, you didn't seem to be too impressed. I mean, just the humanity of it, isn't it? There's a nurse standing next to a bloke.
It's no response.
I mean, I'm not really, you know, because I had a tube down my throat, and I think a tracheostomy, so I couldn't sort of chat away. You know, with the tube down my throat, and she's going, I support Derby. I mean, come on. I mean, the poignancy of that.
Yeah, yeah. That's...
So, of course, to record it and put it in, just amazing. And that one of the last letters by that nurse, Wincy, who I happen to know is Jamaican, I found out since. And what did she say? She didn't say God bless. I think she said God bless or Godspeed. And I'm not religious, but every time I read that, I'm just overwhelmed by it. And partly because I know that, you know, she's come from another place, thousands of miles away. And she's saying to this bloke who, you know, is a complete stranger, you know, I've forgotten the exact word she uses, but it's so moving every time I see it. And when I did the film of it, I had to stop at that point, even though I've read it 100 times. So to be able to be the carrier, that was a word that folk singers use, and folklorists and folk collectors use, that I became the carrier of the nurse's words It's wonderful. It's a privilege.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's very moving, just even thinking about it. What do you think is the therapeutic value of writing? I mean, I always feel as a writer that it's a real lifeline. And, you know, I was thinking when you were talking about losing Eddie and that gap afterwards where you just felt a blank, you know, that's a frightening idea to me. The thought that if something awful happened that I wouldn't be able to use words to try and make sense of it, because that's always just what I do with everything. And I think for all, not just for writers, all sorts of people use words in that way, but certainly for writers, it's so central to who you are. What do you think for you the therapeutic value of writing has been?
I think there's a sense that you're getting it out of yourself. It's relief and release. Then there's a sense that you've made an order of it. Now, you've got to be a bit careful here. It's not the order. It's not the only order, because you could express it in 30 different ways. But it is an order. And then when it is an order, then the feelings that you had in the that are uncontrollable, a sense it's all a kind of miasma, it's all swirling round. You know, when you look at water and it's got sort of, it seems formless, water, right? I mean, we know chemically it isn't, but it seems formless and you swirl your hands around it. That's what, when you're having all these difficult feelings, that's what it can feel like. So if you can then put it into a shape and a structure, then at least it's in a structure, and that then enables you to then critique it yourself. So it's outside of yourself. It's like as almost as if it's an object, and you can look at it and ask yourself questions. Is that honest? Is that authentic? Is it how I am? And you can make comparisons. You can compare it to other bits of writing, to other people, things that other people say. And you can compare it to yourself in a month's time, 2 months' time, 8 months' time, 2 years' time, whatever. I mean, I can look at the sad book and go, I don't feel like that still. That captured me at a particular moment. And even with many different kinds of love, it's beginning to be a bit like that, that captured that moment. And I feel glad about that. That's great. So then you've got another kind of comparison. And I think the thing about comparisons is they're very cool. I don't mean cool in a groovy sense. I mean, it's cool in the kind of Marshall McLuhan sense. There's no heat in analogizing. You're going, oh, yeah, that's like that, that's like that. It's a bit forensic.
Yeah.
And again, that's a relief. If you can do analogies on yourself, and whether that's analogizing one experience with another experience in your own life or analogizing out from you to other people, that's a cool thing to be doing. And so it does cool down the heat in all that swirling, whirling, watery stuff.
Yeah. That's a really interesting way of thinking about it.
And there is just one other little bit, is that you can be satisfied, right? I mean, if you're, you know, in difficulty, you know, depressed, agony, you know, if it hurts your feelings and so on, to do something that makes you satisfied, well, that's better than feeling depressed, isn't it?
Mm.
Or bereaved, you know, in pain because of bereavement or somebody's deserted you or whatever it is. You go, I've got that. So there's that moment of satisfaction. I mean, it's analogous to me writing about my family in the Holocaust. I mean, there's no relief from that, but there's a satisfaction in having found out about it, put it down on paper and shared it, and people responding to it. So there's a satisfaction in the midst of the pain or the tragedy.
Mm.
So
I think it also might be something to do with making something and creating something. You're sort of adding to the world in some respect, and you're making something, and that feels more positive just in itself.
Yeah. I mean, it is lovely. I mean, I don't know whether you write and so on, whether you feel a companionship being in this thing that Zola called the Republic of Letters. I mean, I do. I mean, you see all these thousands of books here. I obviously think they're my mates, don't I? You know, I come in here and it's sort of, you know, it's quite funny, really. But my dad used to have And when my mum was dying, he had a kind of nightmare that repeated, and was that all his papers, I mean, he used to tell it as sort of a joke, all his papers were in the room upstairs, he imagined. They weren't, but he imagined them. And that in his dream, that he got crushed by them, you see. And so what he said to me was it was like a parody of his life, that here was the biggest tragedy that ever happened to him, that he'd been with my mum since they were 16 and they'd never been with anybody else. And here she was dying when she was 56. And he couldn't imagine life. I mean, he really couldn't. I know that. And so what he was talking about was the absurdity of having invested so much energy in, as he would put, swearing with the F, you know, whether we can on this podcast, but anyway, sure. Yes, these fucking papers. And here he was dying of being, you know, as it were, suffocated by his own papers. Well, I've sort of moved on a bit and I've made it these books, you know, that sort of, here are all my friends and I imagine they're all going to kind of fall on me.
Well, you're going to get crushed between the
I'm going to get crushed in between,
maybe,
yes. Yeah. I don't know why I imposed it on you.
But what that a way to go.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. With my friends, yeah. The books, my real friends. Yes.
I looked at there's a complete bibliography on your website and it's astonishing. You are very, very prolific. Do you see yourself ever slowing down? It certainly doesn't seem like you're interested in slowing down at the moment.
No, that sounds like a horrible idea. No, I mean, slowing down sounds like, you know, a group of editors have said, actually, we don't really want to publish any more by you. Thank you, Michael Rosen. So when you say slowing down, the first image that came to me is an editor saying to me, not this one, Michael.
Oh, no.
So from my end, I can't imagine it. But I do sometimes imagine, well, I do send stuff off they turn down. I mean, they do. But I try not to be put off by it and then try and write something else. And then occasionally I write something and send it off and I don't hear for 10 years.
Really?
And then 10 years later they go, this would make a very good book. And I thought, yeah, I thought so 10 years ago. It's funny you've thought so now. So there is a book coming out in October. I think it's about 10 years in the making. It's been with that publisher for about 10 years, I think so.
Gosh. And how did they come back to it now?
I think in this one, they've kept coming back to it and nibbling at it and saying this bit or that bit. And could you maybe not a coyote?
I think that people listening to this will feel comforted to know that because, you know, obviously you're very successful writer, and I think it's nice to hear that even very successful writers sometimes have things turned down and sometimes have things delayed or
good writers can write crap. I mean, it's the other way of thinking about it, is that, and that publishers don't have to feel that they've got to publish something. I mean really, really huge writers can like demand that a publisher does publish it, otherwise they can't have the next thing after that, so publishers get a bit nervous.
Is there anything that you find particularly challenging as a writer?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I've wanted to write bigger novels. I've wanted to write a sort of adult novel. I've run through various scenarios. And then I think I've got a bit chicken, really, and I just sort of haven't done it. And I know it would take an enormous amount of time and effort, so I think, well, I might as well go and do another school booking and have a laugh getting kids doing no breathing. So I take the lazy way out. And I think comedy's a bit like that. If you're engaged in comedy, it's so satisfying. You know, I mean, I'm sure Billy Connolly could have written 10 novels and they'd have been quite brilliant. And of course, you notice how quite often comedians sort of drift towards serious, like Lenny Henry does. And it's fine. It's absolutely great. You know, just when he starts talking, he yearns for that buzz that you get from comedy. And there's nothing to be ashamed of. You know, comedy is a certain magic. You know, you've got a room full of people laughing, having a good time. I seduce myself to doing some of these gigs and so on and reaching people that way. I mean, who knows? You know, there may not be time to write a novel. As I say, I've had one or two ideas in my head that
I'm sure there's time. Do you remember any pieces of advice you've received over the years or things you've read that have led to sort of a real improvement in your writing? So kind of something that somebody said to you and you've thought, yes, that's how I should be doing it, or...
I once interviewed Maurice Gleitzman, and I think I asked him something about his style, and he said, always start the chapter or the book at the latest possible point. And I said, sorry, what does that mean? He said, well, I learned that from script writing. So, because he'd been a TV script writer, I think. He said, don't waste time going, like the Victorian novelist did, you know, it was the day was like this, and the you know, if you think of Thomas Hardy, he tells you all about the heath and what it's like in, what is it, Return of the Native, I think. Or, you know, how you see somebody far off and you don't know who they are, you know, quite a lot of these. Brilliant. I mean, they're like sort of film things. I mean, it's incredible that he wrote film scripts, Thomas Hardy is, before the age of film. I mean, it is quite amazing. But they are quite long intros before you get to the real meat and potatoes, you see. So Maurice Gleitzman said, not nowadays. Bumpf. You start in the middle of a conversation or you start in the middle of a scene. You could always go back, he said. It's no problem. But there could be a tease. It can be a puzzle. But make it something.
Looking back on your writing life specifically, what do you feel the most proud of?
I think actually it may be no breathing in class.
Really?
I think it might be standing up in front of 1,000 kids in a theatre and that moment and going, do you know, when I was at school, you know, I had a teacher who was so... And you know, I don't have to go on any further than that these days because so many of them have seen the video and they all shout before I get to the end of the sentence, no breathing. And I just think, I don't know, that's like, I couldn't possibly be prouder of anything than the idea I've created a sort of folk myth. I mean, we did have a strict teacher, but, you know, obviously she did let us breathe. But, and then occasionally, even funnier, of course, there is always a kid who say, is that true? And of course then there's a great roar from the other kids, well, of course he can't breathe, you know. So we've acted out a symbolic thing about school, so it's totally literary as a device because it's totally symbolic, but they love doing it. And there's all the desks, you know, and the kids dying at the back of the class, kaboom, kaboom. And apparently I gather there's a line in it where I say, oh no, there's Melanie. Oh, that's a shame. She's really nice. I used to like Melanie. Apparently, this has become a cult line. So apparently, I get sort of stopped by people, adults, who say, I've got a kid at home. And they come out, they say, have you seen this Michael Rosen thing? And then they go, oh, no, there's Melanie. She said, what's that mean? And I then have to say, because the adult doesn't know. And when I get to that bit in it, oh, no. And I hear, if I do it slowly, they'll go, there's Melanie.
A huge thank you to Michael Rosen, who I loved spending time with. You should definitely buy a book of his. I think my personal favourite is Many Different Kinds of Love, but if you have a child in your life, then there's so much that they will enjoy, and you can browse a selection of his many, many books at uk.bookshop.org/shop/in-writing, and I'm going to put that in the episode notes. I'll put lots of other interesting stuff in there too, including a link to Michael's YouTube channel for children and the film of Many Different Kinds of Love and Michael's BBC Radio 4 series Word of Mouth, which looks at the world of words. This is the last episode of this season of In Writing, and I want to say a huge thank you to everyone who listened, shared or got in touch about it, as well as to all my brilliant guests. If you've just tuned in for Michael Rosen and this is your first ever episode of In Writing, then you might want to go back and see if any other episodes appeal to you. I've now released 52 interviews in total, talking to novelists, journalists, poets, screenwriters, memoirists, and lots more. Until the podcast returns, you can keep up with In Writing via my newsletter on the writing process. That's at inwriting.substack.com. I'm currently planning a special edition of the newsletter where I will answer questions about this podcast. So if you have questions about particular favourite episodes, or if you have questions about podcasting or about interviewing in general, please go to inwriting.substack.com and leave a comment and I'll try to answer. A reminder before we go of my exclusive discount code for Curtis Brown Creative's short online writing courses. Use the code INWRITING20 for £20 off.
Visit curtisbrowncreative.co.uk to find out more about all their courses currently open for enrolment or application. That's all for now. Thank you so much for listening.